Like many stories of the West, the gap between fact and fiction can be wide. In the case of John Wesley Hardin, his story has the typical inconsistencies that come with the attempt to chronicle events that happened more than 100 years ago. Witness accounts vary wildly. Oftentimes, Hardin himself was the only witness, and his word is notoriously untrustworthy. He admitted to roughly 25 murders, and we have to say roughly because even he didn't know, or he lost track over time. On top of that, he was credited with more than 40 killings. But what doesn't make him typical was that his father was a Methodist preacher, and his mother was loving and devoted. He didn't experience the same type of trauma that Jesse James experienced during the Civil War years. The war was a motivator for both Hardin and Jesse, but for different reasons. And Hardin didn't have a chaotic childhood like Billy the Kid, a childhood that seemed to lead Billy from one unfortunate event to another. So it's all the more mysterious that John Wesley Hardin became one of the most prolific killers to ever walk the earth. In his own account of his life, he wasn't a cold-blooded monster. He said he never killed anybody who didn't need killing. But in many cases, that was patently false. In others, it was debatable. In some, he might have been right. But regardless of the numbers or the reasons why, we know his name at all because he was a killer. He didn't spend years robbing banks and trains like Jesse James or Butch and Sundance. He didn't lead a vendetta during a range war like Billy the Kid. He just seemed to use his gun to solve problems, or perceived problems, more than anyone. Some of Hardin's reports about his life and timeline have been corroborated by historians and eyewitnesses, but others are available only through Hardin himself. So, the tale of John Wesley Hardin is going to fall squarely into the category of a legend of the Old West. It's an incredible story, but be prepared. It's also bloody as hell. Consider yourself warned as we dive into the life of one of the most infamous outlaws of the American West. It's springtime, and if one of your springtime goals, like me, is the eternal quest to get in a little bit better shape, that starts with food. Eating healthy, but also being busy, equals Factor Meals. Fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted meals delivered right to your door. There's no prep, no cleanup. Just heat them and eat them, and most are ready in 2 minutes. There are 35 weekly menu options, which includes gourmet options with premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, and more. There are options for all types of meals, day or night. Tailor the delivery schedule to your schedule. And this month celebrates Earth Day, so look for meals with the badge Earth Month Eats to reduce carbon footprints. Head to factormeals.com/LOTOW50 and use code LOTOW50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code LOTOW50 at factormeals.com/LOTOW50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. From Black Barrel Media, this is Legends of the Old West. I'm your host, Chris Wimmer. In this season, we're telling the stories of two outlaws, John Wesley Hardin and Henry Plummer. This is Episode 1, John Wesley Hardin, Hero or Villain? John Wesley Hardin was named after the 18th century English cleric who founded the Methodist Church. The midwife who delivered John Wesley into the world allegedly said he would either be a great hero or a monumental villain. It's one of those perfect quotes that was almost certainly dreamed up after the fact, but it's a fun part of the legend. John Wesley was born to James and Elizabeth Hardin on May 23, 1853, in Fannin County, Texas, near the Oklahoma border. And according to his biography, his first exposure to deadly violence came at the tender age of 8. Young John Wesley witnessed a man hit another man with a cane. That in itself was a fairly benign assault, but the man who received the blow pulled out a Bowie knife. He slit his attacker's throat and left him to bleed to death in the street. That was the part that probably had a lasting effect on the boy. But there was another bloody event that had a profound impact on John Wesley Hardin, like it did on almost everyone else in the country: the Civil War. Hardin's family were Texas Confederates, and he desperately wanted to run away and join the war to kill Yankees at the age of 9. He and one of his cousins conspired to do just that. But his father, by John's account, found out about the plan and gave him a good thrashing. Hardin couldn't join the war effort, but his hatred for the Northern cause and those who fought for it never went away. At age 14, he had a run-in with a classmate named Charles Sloter. Charles aspired to be, as John put it, the boss among the boys. The problem was that John aspired to the same position. In their schoolyard power struggle, Charles launched a smear campaign that accused John of scrawling an obscene rhyme on the school wall about a girl in their class. John was somehow able to prove that it was another boy who wrote the offensive rhyme. That put Charles on the defensive. According to Hardin, Charles confronted John at his desk by first slugging him and then pulling out a knife. John responded by grabbing the knife from Charles and stabbing him in the chest and the back. Charles nearly died, but John didn't suffer any consequences for the attack because it was deemed self-defense. Charles Sloter recovered from his injuries, but the next victim didn't. At age 15, John graduated to murder. He was visiting his uncle Barnett Hardin, who lived in Livingston, Texas, not far from John's home in Sumter. It all began when a cousin arranged for he and John to challenge a former slave named Major to a wrestling match somewhere near Uncle Barnett's farm. Mage, as he was called, was a strong man with a muscular build who was known for his wrestling abilities. Even in the two-against-one match, it didn't look very promising for John and his cousin. As a crowd gathered to watch what was sure to be a humiliating defeat for the teenagers, the young men proved to be better wrestlers than Mage anticipated. John was able to throw Mage to the ground twice and scratch him badly in the process. Mage apparently became enraged and, according to John, left the fight to go get his pistol. He supposedly proclaimed, "No white boy could draw his blood and live," and, "A bird never flew too high not to come to the ground." John claimed he feared for his life. He returned with his cousin to his uncle's farm to get his Colt pistol. He intended to return for a showdown, but his uncle was able to intercede and calm John down. Unfortunately, the confrontation with Mage had not been stopped. It had just been postponed. When John was returning home to Sumter the next day, he ran into Mage along the way. According to Hardin's version of the story, Mage began to curse and abuse him and called him a coward for not shooting it out the night before. Hardin claimed he apologized to Mage for scratching him and told him that he never intended to hurt him. According to Hardin's account, which, not surprisingly, puts him in the best possible light and points to Mage as the aggressor, the former slave was not satisfied with Hardin's apology. Mage attacked Hardin with a stick, threatening to kill him and throw his body in a nearby creek. Hardin claimed he pulled his Colt and gave Mage fair warning to back away and let him pass. Mage ignored the warning and grabbed the bridle of Hardin's horse. At that point, Hardin fired. He then claimed that Mage kept coming back at him, so he kept shooting, presumably until he emptied his pistol and Mage finally collapsed. Although badly wounded, Mage was still alive, so Hardin rode to yet another uncle's house. This uncle was not only Mage's one-time owner, but he was also a local judge. The two returned to the scene and found Mage, who was remarkably still alive, but just barely. The judge is said to have taken him home in an effort to save him, but Mage died soon afterward. One of Hardin's uncles, either the judge or Uncle Barnett, gave him a gold piece and told him to go home, tell his parents what he'd done, and then go into hiding. This was 1868, so Reconstruction was in full swing, and Texas was filled with Union soldiers and carpetbaggers. Those Texans who had supported the Confederate cause believed they were being singled out and treated unjustly by the new Northern Provisional Government. Union soldiers were there to see that Texas Confederates and their sympathizers followed the law, and if they did not, the soldiers would dole out the appropriate punishment. One new law that Southerners had to adjust to was that murdering a black man or woman was now a hanging offense. New laws didn't stop that much violence, but they did set Union soldiers on the trail of John Wesley Hardin. When Hardin told his parents that he had killed a black man, they feared for their son's life. Convinced he would never get a fair trial, they sent him to live with Mrs. Hardin's sister, Susanna Morgan, and her husband, who lived at Richland Crossing in Navarro County, Texas. John's older brother, Joe, was a schoolteacher and lived near the Morgan's farm. He allegedly heard a rumor that three Union soldiers, two white and one black, were looking for John and planned to arrest him for Mage's murder. So Joe rode to the Morgan's farm to warn his brother. There's no evidence that the army sent three soldiers to arrest Hardin, but the rumor was enough to get Hardin to act. Hardin didn't want to keep running, and he didn't want to wait for the soldiers to track him down. In his own account, he found a place to hide near a creek where he thought the soldiers would likely stop to water their horses. When they did, he planned to ambush them. In his autobiography, Hardin proudly described what happened next. The soldiers stopped at the creek, just like he thought they would, and he wrote, "I had no mercy on men whom I knew only wanted to get my body to torture and kill. I brought it on by opening the fight with a double-barrel shotgun and ending it with a cap-and-ball six-shooter." After the ambush, Hardin said he buried the soldiers in a dried-up creek bed. Nobody knows if the details of the attack on the soldiers are true, and nobody knows if the soldiers were on their way to arrest Hardin or if they were just passing through. But according to John Wesley Hardin, he ambushed and killed three Union soldiers when he was just 15 years old. That brought his body count up to four, and he was just getting warmed up. After the ambush, Hardin returned to Sumter to confess to his father, the Reverend James Hardin. This strange ritual would happen over and over in Hardin's early years. The Reverend was certain there would be a posse looking for his son now, and even more certain he would be hanged if he were captured. So Reverend Hardin traveled with John to Spring Hill in north central Texas, where they had more family who could hide and protect him. The Reverend also secured a teaching position for his son. It was 1869, and John had just turned 16. One of his ex-pupils recalled John being a very strict teacher who prayed before class every morning. It was the interesting dichotomy of John Wesley Hardin, because it wasn't long before he committed his fifth murder. It happened when John and a cousin named Simp Dixon, a proud member of the Ku Klux Klan, came across a squad of Union soldiers. The cousins shared a hatred for Yankees, and they saw an opportunity to take revenge. They launched a surprise attack, and Hardin and Dixon shot and killed a soldier each, and then somehow fled without being captured. 16-year-old John Wesley Hardin had now, by his own count, killed five men. Simp Dixon was later apprehended for the murders, and he was executed by a firing squad at the age of 19. Hardin went on the run again. This time he hid out with his brother Joe in the Texas Hill Country. By then, their parents had moved to an adjoining county, hoping they could encourage their son to give up his wicked ways. It didn't work. On Christmas Eve, John's father tried to bring John back to the family's new home for Christmas. But on Christmas Day, 1869, John borrowed his father's horse and rode to a nearby horse track. Hardin had developed a fondness for gambling, and he wanted to bet on the races. According to Hardin's account, he won $350 in gold. After the races, and hoping to keep his winning streak going, he joined a game of draw poker at a nearby grocery store with three men from Arkansas, Jim Bradley, Hamp Davis, and Judge Moore. The cards were with John that day, and he apparently won all the money on the table. And Jim Bradley took exception. Whether he believed John was cheating, or he was just a sore loser who didn't want to pay up to a teenager, is unknown. But whatever his reasoning, Bradley pulled his gun on Harden and demanded his money back. Caught off guard, Harden had no choice but to oblige. Bradley then made him take off his boots before threatening to shoot him if he didn't leave. Humiliated, bootless, and broke, Harden left the store as directed. And Jim Bradley had no idea that he'd just made the worst and last mistake of his life. Harden went to see a friend who lived nearby, borrowed a pistol, and returned to the grocery store. Bradley was still playing cards. John approached the table, pulled out his pistol, and shot Bradley multiple times in the head and chest. Harden retrieved his boots and left Jim Bradley on the floor. Harden went back to confess to his father that he'd killed another man. Jim Bradley was number 6. Harden hid with his family for a while, but soon his father learned the bad news. Authorities discovered John's whereabouts, and a posse was on its way to arrest John for the murder of Jim Bradley. It looked like John may have finally been cornered, but cornering John Wesley Harden was no easy task. And this time, Harden tried a different tactic. When Harden's father warned his son that a posse was on its way to arrest him for another murder, Harden decided to go on the offensive again. Rather than wait for them to come to him, Harden and some friends rode out to greet the men. But instead of waging a violent attack, John politely asked to see their warrant, a document they didn't have. Harden and his friends made it clear that without an arrest warrant, Harden would not surrender. They also strongly suggested that it would be in the best interest of the men of the posse and their wives and children to turn around and ride home. Harden and his crew outnumbered the posse, and after a brief standoff, the posse decided to heed the warning. The men turned and rode away. For the first time, Harden used words instead of guns, and he successfully avoided a shootout. But the bloodless streak didn't last long. Harden kicked off the new year of 1870 with two more confrontations. The first occurred when Harden and a friend named Alec Berrickman were on their way to visit a Harden relative. They came across a traveling circus that had stopped to camp for the night. Harden and Berrickman asked the circus people if they could warm themselves by the fire, and they were invited to join. At some point, for unknown reasons, Harden and one of the circus performers got into a fight. Harden settled the argument by shooting and killing the circus performer. Assuming the circus people would chase them, Harden and Berrickman decided to split up so they would be more difficult to track. Harden rode to the tiny town of Cossey, Texas. He met a young lady outside the Dillon Hotel and was instantly smitten. Unfortunately, she had another admirer, her boyfriend, who was a former soldier and not at all happy about Harden's flirtations. The soldier decided to teach Harden a lesson by robbing him. Harden gave the man the impression he was cooperating and pulled some money out of his pocket, then purposefully dropped it on the ground. The boyfriend bent over to grab it, and when he stood back up, he was surprised to see Harden's gun pointed at his head. Harden supposedly killed the man on the spot. But as with many of Harden's stories, the details are disputed. Another version is that the woman in question was a prostitute and the man was her boss. And it's impossible to know if it happened at all. But either way, Harden was just 16 years old and now claiming he'd killed 8 men. After a busy January, Harden evidently decided to slow down a bit. He went to work on an uncle's farm near Brenham, Texas. And I can't mention Brenham without also saying, for the new listeners, that that's where this podcast started. I was working in Brenham when I launched this show. I love that town. Check it out if you get the chance. So Harden worked with his uncle and his cousins by day, and by night, he took his wages into town to gamble. But after a while, Harden realized he was not only gambling with his wages, he was also gambling with his freedom. He heard persistent rumors that a relatively new law enforcement agency, the Texas State Police, was hunting for him for the murder of Jim Bradley. Apparently, a reward was now being offered, and Harden decided it was time to leave Brenham. For the next several months, he traveled alone, mostly after dark, throughout central Texas, visiting friends and relatives and hiding from the law. But late in 1870, he decided to head to Louisiana, where he had still more relatives, and where he would be out of reach of Texas authorities. But before he made it, his luck ran out in Longview, Texas. He was arrested and thrown in jail while he waited to be transferred to Waco to stand trial for Jim Bradley's murder. While he was in jail, he was somehow able to buy a pistol from another prisoner. He initially intended to use it to escape before his transfer, but he missed his chance. State Police Lieutenant E.T. Stokes, Private James Smalley, and a civilian named L.B. Anderson arrived to escort Hardin to Waco. It was a 160-mile ride from East Texas to Central Texas, and the three men didn't know that their prisoner had managed to hide a weapon under his shirt by hanging it from a string under his arm. Hardin planned to use the gun at the first opportunity, but on the trail, he was going to try some frontier theatrics to help grease the wheels for his escape. Hardin proved he was not only a ruthless killer, but a wily one at that. Hardin tried to make his captors think he was less of a threat than he actually was. He played himself off as a timid and weak young man who was terrified by the prospect of being hanged. The act apparently served to create a false sense of security for the lawmen, and they slowly let their guard down. For one of them, it was a deadly mistake. According to a local newspaper report written at the time, the group rode into the town of Marshall, Texas, in late January 1871. Lieutenant Stokes and the civilian assistant Anderson stopped in town, presumably to buy supplies, but Private Smalley continued riding with Hardin. Smalley and Hardin rode for another 2 miles beyond town before they stopped for the night. Hardin now had the perfect opportunity to escape, and he took advantage of it. As Smalley began to set up camp, Hardin pulled out his concealed Colt 45 and shot the private in the back. Smalley turned to draw his pistol, and Hardin shot him in the stomach. By that point, Stokes and Anderson were within earshot of the gunfire, and they raced to the campsite. They arrived just in time to see Hardin gallop away on Smalley's horse. Private Smalley was dead on the ground, and John Wesley Hardin was back on the run. He had now killed 9 men, and he was 17 years old. Hardin fled to, where else, the safety of his father. Each time the son returned home, the situation was more desperate than the last. John Wesley was wanted by the army for killing multiple soldiers. He was wanted by local authorities for killing Jim Bradley. And now he would be wanted by the state police for killing an officer. Hardin's father gave him a fresh horse and told him to ride for the Mexican border. Apparently, Hardin accepted the idea and began the journey. According to Hardin's autobiography, he was arrested near Waco by 3 men who said they were Texas state policemen. The arrest is suspicious and largely uncorroborated. Hardin claimed that his most recent captors proceeded to get drunk around the campfire that night, and when they passed out, he was able to untie himself, and then he killed all 3 men with their own guns. One Texas state police officer was listed as killed in action during this period of time, but it was never determined whether or not he was one of the men Hardin claimed to have killed. If Hardin's claims are correct, his body count was now up to an even dozen. After his second escape, if it actually happened, Hardin abandoned his solo trip to Mexico and returned home to update his father on his latest sins. Reverend Hardin decided he would have to take an active role in his son's escape if John was going to make it all the way to Mexico. He would ride with John and get him as close to the Mexican border as he could. Sometime in late January or early February of 1871, father and son rode off toward Mexico. Despite Reverend Hardin's desire to escort his son to the border, he didn't make it very far. The Reverend said goodbye to his son somewhere near Belton, Texas, halfway between Waco and Austin. That was still more than 200 miles from the border. After the pair parted, John rode to the Gonzales area, where he stopped to visit another batch of relatives. They were the Clements family, and they talked John into joining them on a cattle drive to Kansas. They thought a cattle drive would be a good way to move through the area, and when Hardin made it to Kansas, it would be easier to hide from Texas lawmen. Hardin liked the idea, and he scrapped his plan to flee to Mexico. Later that spring, John Wesley Hardin and his cousins headed north on the Chisholm Trail. Their destination was Abilene, Kansas, where legendary lawman and gunfighter Wild Bill Hickok was the new marshal. But wherever Hardin went, there was trouble, and there would be gunplay on the trail long before he made it to Abilene. Next time on Legends of the Old West, John Wesley Hardin runs afoul of Native American warriors and Mexican vaqueros and kills a man in an Abilene hotel and then finds true love. That's next week on Legends of the Old West. And members of our Black Barrel Plus program don't have to wait week to week for new episodes. They receive the entire season to binge all at once with no commercials. Sign up now through the link in the show notes or on our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. Memberships begin at just $5 per month. This series was researched and written by Michael Byrne. Original music by Rob Valier. I'm your host and producer, Chris Wimmer. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Check out our website, blackbarrelmedia.com, for more details and join us on social media. We're at Old West Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. This show is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Please visit airwavemedia.com to check out other great podcasts like Ben Franklin's World, Once Upon a Crime, and many more. Thanks for listening.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.